And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Hands-On Apologetics. I am Gary Machuda, and that was a great save by our engineer. Yes, you must always be careful which buttons you push. Otherwise, you could end up not being on the air. But luckily, things worked out. Thanks a lot, Richard. And welcome, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, where we jump into defending, explaining, sharing the faith with charity and clarity. And it's great to be with you today. I hope everybody had a great week. We actually had some strong storms coming in through the Midwest Command Center, and it knocked out our power. Hence, no live program yesterday. But as you can see, the Command Center is back up and running, and the dojo is ready for action. So thank you so much for your prayers. We appreciate it very much, and got a great show in store for you today. A lot of objections against Catholicism is based on a kind of Americanized version or Americanized understanding of the Bible in the early church. And so some of the objections that Protestants have here in America, the other Protestants in Europe and elsewhere in the world don't have. And so there's a different way you could approach things in regards to a few of these objections, and that is from the Eastern perspective, which brings me to our guest today. We are going to have our Maronite Rite Catholic apologist, Paul Thomas, come back to the dojo. And we're going to talk about apologetics Eastern Rite style. And he's a wealth of information because he's, you know, apologist, he's Maronite Rite, he's Lebanese, he's Catholic through and through, and so he has a totally different approach to answering a lot of the common objections that we run into in the Latin Rite. So he's going to come on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about just answering common objections and so on, and his approach, his style, viewing things from the Eastern Church. So great stuff in store for us today. And by the way, if you have any questions for Paul, you can give us a call at 888-526-2151. That is 888-526-2151. And we'd love to hear from you. And as always, you know what? Let's do our shout-outs. I already welcome everybody listening live on radio. So I want to welcome everybody listening and watching live via the social media. That is via Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. And great to see familiar names. Thank you, Michelle, for the emoji explosion. Lots of sheep. And I get why it's there, too. So I appreciate it. And I want to welcome all of you listening on podcast. You know, I understand, we have quite a few listeners who have listened through via podcast, even though this is live broadcast. And, I understand this, the time of day, it's right around lunch maybe. And, you are listening to an interview and you kind of want to hear the rest of the story, but you have to get back to work or things come up around the house. You can always listen to us via podcast at virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Yes. Go to our flagship, website. And you can go to our shows, go down to Hands-On Apologetics or any of the other awesome shows that's produced by Virgin Most Powerful, and bang, you are there. You can listen to the rest of the program. You can listen to past programs. You can download it, and you can share it with your friends. And by the way, please do, because we want to share the good news. We want to share this arsenal that we're forming here at Hands-On Apologetics and helping people explain defending faith, and let people know about us. Share us, like us on social media, do all those great things, and we appreciate spreading the word, because like I said, it's too good to keep to ourselves. The faith is just so amazing that we should be sharing it every chance we get. every chance. And also talk about sharing the faith. Yeah, I know, Michelle. Yeah, Michelle's like, I put the sheep up, it's not because you're boring. I know. But thank you for that disclaimer, though. I appreciate it. As always, we look at sharpening our critical thinking skills, and also we meet one of the early church fathers in our first segment. And today's Finding the Fallacy, by the way, is a cool one. It's called the Texas Sharpshooter Fallacy. And we're going to also meet the early church father, who was actually a biggie. Maybe not as much of a household name as Jerome or Ambrose or Augustine, but nevertheless, a very influential figure. That is Didymus the Blind. So we're going to meet Didymus the Blind today. So why don't we jump into our Finding the Fallacy, which is the Sharpshooter Fallacy. It's an informal fallacy which is committed when differences in data are ignored, but similarities are overemphasized. In other words, you have a group of data, and you focus only on those things, the similarities, and you ignore the things that don't fit into the big picture. And in a way, it's almost like a statistic cherry picking. You know, you kind of see a pattern, you pick the things that kind of fit into your theory, and you ignore the stuff that contradicts it. It's a false cause fallacy. In other words, you're identifying a false cause because basically you're trying to make the data fit your conclusion while ignoring the stuff that doesn't. Texas Sharpshooter Fallacy comes actually from a story, as I understand it. It was coined as a marksman was shooting randomly at barns, and then later he would paint bullseyes over the groupings of the bullets. And of course, you know, that makes it appear that it wasn't just random shooting, but he is actually like hitting a target. And that's kind of like how this fallacy works. You have a gun, you know, you have these different points of data that's kind of all over, and you kind of paint the target around a cluster. This happens, I think, a lot with a group called the Mythicists, who try to, they claim that Christianity is nothing but an amalgamation of old pagan myths. And so Christianity is kind of like a super myth made up of all these pagan myths. And they try to prove that there's a dependency of Christianity on these myths by pointing out all the similarities, like between a pagan god or a goddess and something that Christianity teaches. Well, this is a classic example of the Texas Sharpshooter Fallacy, because what they do is they ignore all the differences. And the differences not only are more, but incredibly significant differences. But, you know, that's kind of off the radar screen, and you focus only on similarities. And so the way to avoid this fallacy, by the way, is to go out of the way to point out the differences. You know, I always, whenever somebody says, see, look at this group of data, it points in this direction, I always focus my attention on, okay, where are the dissimilarities? Where are the things that don't fit in? What's the big picture? And if you do that, folks, you will not commit this fallacy, which is the Texas Sharpshooter Fallacy. Our Finding the Fallacy for today. All right, let's jump to meet the early church father. And like I said, he's a biggie. He's Didymus the Blind, who was born sometime around 313 and died AD 398. So he's an early church father. He's born in Alexandria. And by the way, he became blind around the age of 4. Yet he became one of the most learned men and one of the most prolific authors of his age. Under St. Athanasius, Didymus became the head of the famed catechetical school in Alexandria. If you remember, that school focuses on the allegorical understanding of Scripture, and it was incredibly famous in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. Well, actually, this is near the end, beginning of right when Didymus, because Didymus, in fact, became the head of the school, and he also was the last head of that school, because after his death, the school moved to Side. And shortly closed. So he was the last of the great teachers of the school, catechetical school in Alexandria. He had incredibly famous students, by the way, and those students are Jerome and Rufinus. We talked about Jerome. You know, Jerome's so important with biblical scholarship. Rufinus was a one-time friend of Jerome turned enemy, but nevertheless, they're both students under Didymus the Blind. Didymus was not especially, this is according to Jurgen's Faith of the Early Fathers, he says he's not especially an original thinker, but his prodigious memory enabled him to gain masterful knowledge of philosophy and theology, along with geometry, astronomy, and arithmetic. Contemporaries of Didymus knew him as a man of considerable insight and extreme kindness. There's nothing invective in his writings, which is kind of ironic because Jerome is nothing but invective in his writings. So he didn't really learn much from the great teacher Didymus in that regard. And also he shows a rather angelic disposition, even to people dealing with heretics. He condemns doctrine, but he never condemns the person. And consequently, he was very well liked and in good terms, even with Arians, the Arian heretics. He remained always a layman, although he lived as an ascetic outside of Alexandria, even while he was the head of the catechetical school in Alexandria. As far as doctrine's concerned, his Trinitarian doctrine is a model of soundness, and generally his doctrine is pretty much correct, except for, unfortunately, he was influenced by Origen of Alexandria in that he regarded that souls preexisted, and ultimately that there would be salvation for all. Those doctrines came from Origen. Didymus apparently kind of imbibed them, and as a result, he never became a saint, and also a lot of his writings were lost. Although we have recently, as 1941, discovered some new ones. So that is our early father for today, Didymus the Blind. And coming up on the other side of the break, apologetics, Eastern Rite style with Paul Thomas. Stay tuned.
This is Jesse Romero.
And I'm Terry Barber.
From the Terry and Jesse Show. And we invite you to listen to the Holy Hour of Power, High Energy Catholic Radio. We're two Catholics with a PhD in common sense. We're on Monday through Friday on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
What we're going to give you is masculine Catholic teachings on the faith. You know, we say we're too inspired to be tired, we're too protected to be dejected, and we're too renewed to be subdued. Why? Because we believe in Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church. And we will take each issue of the day and show you how the Catholic Church has the answer for our culture. What we really do is bring men back into the Catholic Church, which it's about time to do. We want men to be leaders in their Catholic faith so that they can bring their family to heaven.
Our program is not right versus left, it's right versus wrong. And our program is where Catholicism and culture intersect. It's High Energy Catholic Radio.
We're going to inspire you to fall deeper in love with Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church.
The Terry and Jesse Show on the Virgin Most Powerful app.
Psalm 119 says, "Your word is a lamp for my feet and a light to my path." According to St. John Paul II, being a Christian means saying yes to Jesus Christ. It consists in surrendering to the Word of God and relying on it, but also endeavoring to know better and better the profound meaning of this Word. May God grant that we always rely on His Word, read it often, and put it into practice.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. Well, as I said before, many times Protestant objections to Catholicism actually comes from More from American culture than a biblical worldview. In fact, some things that some objections that we get here in the United States is often things that other places of the church would kind of roll their eyes at, because it doesn't make any sense if you're getting the perspective of Eastern Catholicism. And to help inform us about that perspective, we have Master Apologist Paul Thomas coming into the dojo. Paul Thomas is a well-known speaker, and he's very popular with youth and adult groups here in Southeast Michigan. And it's always fun to have him on the show. So, Paul Thomas, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hi, Sensei. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I'm planning on saying that for days.
Well, you know, this is the Apologetics Dojo, so I guess so. But you actually are, since you're the guest, you take over sensei duties, and I just sit and listen to your teaching.
Ah, my pupil. Little grasshopper.
You are the temporary Mr. Miyagi for
awesome.
The program. Yeah, there you go. So, it's always great to talk to you. You know, Paul, we're getting lots and lots of new listeners, new people listening to podcasts. Some people might not know the background of your story. Maybe could you give a short, summary of your journey of faith?
Jeez, it's always so hard to do this cliff notes. oh, boy. Raised in a really good Orthodox Catholic family, just... Mm-hmm. Had the childhood everyone dreamed of, and just strayed. I don't know how I strayed, but I did. And I didn't stray a little bit. I strayed a lot. I never really got into like thieving and murdering and real hard stuff, but I was really into drugs and making money. And unfortunately, I was really good at it. And, it's one thing to be bad at it and get caught and get in trouble, and then you're at rock bottom, and then you turn to God. I never really hit rock bottom until I prayed to hit rock bottom. And I was doing so well and making so much money. I felt empty. I was searching for it, but I just couldn't give it up on my own. And one day I prayed probably the first time in 13 to 15 years and prayed for God to be a father and to whip my behind and take it away from me. And 24 hours later, it happened. And that was a day that changed my life. And there's all kinds of series of miracles that happened after that, but that was my great awakening. It's what I asked for. And it was a day I realized God is not just some, idea. He's real. He's a person. He listens. He cares. He's intimately involved with you. And
he answers prayers.
Changed everything about me. Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you came back, and actually, you didn't come straight back to the church, did you?
No.
You did a little search
yourself.
I honestly
did everything. I did everything I could not to become Catholic. It's because I, as much as I kind of was poorly catechized, not because of my parents. My parents catechized me by the way they lived. But it was really a generation of poor catechesis, no evangelization. And I was kind of raised on the American anti-Catholic, we worship Mary and, re-crucify Jesus and we're pagans. And I sort of just ran with that. And through my journey, God had put me in someone's living room with Paco Gavrilides, which me and you both know he's really big at the major seminary in Detroit. And I had all these objections, and what's funny is they lived around the corner from me for years, and I just happened to fall into their living room one day, and I didn't know Catholics had that many answers for things. I'm like, wow, this guy gave me like 15 answers, not one. So I kind of spent time trying to disprove him, and that's kind of what led me into, I'm a very hard-minded person. If truth sets me into fire, I'd rather burn than live a lie. So I was going to take whatever God gave me, no matter how ugly it seemed to me or wrong. If it's true, I have to wrestle with it. And there was just some truths about the church I could not refute. And pretty soon the Holy Spirit just kind of softened my heart. And then if you listen to my conversion, I had that one, you know, giant miracle with the TV and God literally talking to me in first person. Yeah. And from that night at 12:45 in the morning, I've never been the same. And now look at me, from paid drug dealer to being on Catholic radio. Praise be to Jesus. He does miracles.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah, absolutely.
I know.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
You know, it's you hit a really interesting point because you said that, you know, when you met Paco, you didn't realize that there were Catholics that actually had answers or reasons for, you know, what you believe. I mean, that's really a clarion call, isn't it? I mean, how many people out there are looking for answers and, you know, just Catholics, they don't want to step out of their comfort zone to share.
Well, sometimes you step out of your comfort zone. A lot of Catholics I met on my journey, most of them were what you'd call cafeteria Catholics. Mm-hmm. They were, I'm Catholic, but, you know, I think the church is wrong about contraception. I think it's wrong about abortion. I think it's wrong about divorce and remarriage. I think things are wrong about the Pope, but I'm Catholic. And that's kind of who I was infected with. Until I met Paco and a couple like really super Orthodox Catholics. No, my parents are, but they're not apologists. Hmm. Paco just hammered me like all kinds of answers. And so did Martin, whose house I was in. He's actually the godfather of my oldest son. So that's how much he touched my life. He's not related to me or anything.
Yeah.
And he turned me on to Catholic answers. He gave me like a book from Scott Hahn and Tim Staples. And it sort of, I remember calling Catholic Answers probably 20 times trying to stump them, and they just kind of put me in my place. And pretty soon I just had to go, wow. I mean, other than my family history, you know, we've been Catholic since the beginning. We're from the Holy Land. It's kind of like our family tradition, but I didn't take it so seriously. And like Jesus says, you have eyes, but you can't see, and you have ears, but you're deaf. It kind of takes the Holy Spirit to give you eyes to see that. And just one day, I couldn't believe how blind I was. It was staring me blank in the face.
Yeah.
And look at me now.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, thanks be to God.
Really, and, really cool. I know. Amen.
And, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the background. Because many Catholics, it's funny when you grow up in a Latin Rite church, like here in America, you think that's the church. That's how it is around the world. You know, people around the world are celebrating, you know, the Roman Mass. They're doing it in English. You know, it's just, it's funny how you project your own experience everywhere. But tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about Maronite Rite.
Okay, well, my mom is Syrian and French. My mom is Latin Rite. That's how her mom was French. They're usually Roman Catholic. And her father really didn't practice. And my mom was kind of you don't ask her for intellectual answers, but she evangelizes with how she lives. My mom is like a saint, like literally. So I always seen the love of Christ through her. But my dad has been a Maronite and other family since St. Maduin, 1600 years ago. And what's different with Eastern Rite communities is, you know, you go to a Latin Rite community here in America and it's very mixed. Because honestly, the Latin Rite is in every single country in the world. They're one of the greatest evangelists of the church are from the Latin Rite. They've been everywhere. They're all the way to India, China. So people around the world are very familiar with Latin. And of course, the Pope is the patriarch of the Latin Rite. He's Pope. So you see Catholicism as Latin. And I understand that. We didn't go to the Maronite church all that much when I was young. I probably spent most of my time in a Latin Rite church just because it's very ethnic. And even though my mom's Syrian, it just kind of can, you really got to be steep in the culture sometimes when you go to certain liturgies. Mm-hmm. So then as I kind of grew up, I sort of kind of grew away from it. But when I rediscovered it was the first time I went back to Lebanon with my dad. Mm-hmm. And you really get to see just old, old Christianity, you know, churches that are thousands of years old and, you know, relics that are 1800 years old, original mitres and stuff from our patriarch, John Maroon. And, you know, I was able to touch it. And that's where I really learned my first experience. Really. I mean, I've always known what the Maroonite Rite is, that's when I really got to experience it deeply. And I took that with me. I still hadn't, you know, reverted yet, but I took that with me. Mm-hmm. Once I came back in the church, though, it was kind of due to a couple priests that I knew from St. Charbel. And one's a canon lawyer now who is in Rome. And they really walked me through everything. They baptized my children. They baptized my wife, who was baptized in the Maronite Rite. And that's kind of where I came into the church, and I grew, and I learned how to preach, and I learned everything. And that's where my heart is. And it's where my family's heart has been for 1600 years. So it's kind of like a way of me even connecting with my ancestors in a way. Because the Maronite Rite is very unique. You know, most of the other rites, the liturgical rites of the Catholic Church, are usually location and language. You know, the Byzantine Rite. And in the Byzantine Rite, you have the Ukrainians, the Bulgarians. You know, you have certain ethnic language rites. And because their liturgies are centered around their language, where Maronites are based after a man, St. Maron, as we call him. So his liturgical rite was based out of monasticism. He was a monk during the crazy time of the Council of Chalcedon and the Monophysite heresy, which happened right, you know, in Asia Minor and the Middle East and through North Africa and Egypt. So we were stuck in the middle of it. And he was schooled in Edessa, which is like Turkey today, right at the same time as St. John Chrysostom, when he was working on his liturgy, which is probably, other than the Latin liturgy, the most widely celebrated liturgy in the East. Of all Byzantine uses liturgy.
Oh, sure.
So ours came, St. John Chrysostom. Mm-hmm. And it really hasn't changed at all. Like, it's very ancient and it's beautiful. I would tell any Catholic out there to go experience at least one, any Syriac rite, whether it's Chaldean or Maronite or Melankara or Malabar, and go to a Byzantine liturgy. It's such a gift we have as Catholics that we have more than one expression of our love.
Yeah.
You know, just like you don't love your kids the same as your wife, but you love them. There's just different expressions that we express our love. And the liturgy is how we all express it together. And it's beautiful that there's differences that it's almost like kind of liken it to why we have so many different, I don't want to call them monks, but religious orders.
Yeah.
You know, every certain religious order has its charism that shows a little charism of Christ. The Franciscans is charity, poverty, the Dominicans teaching. And it's amazing. You know, it's almost flabbergasting just how great it is. But I hear the music.
Yep, I hear it too. And we're chatting with Master Apologist Paul Thomas on Apologetics Eastern Rite Style. More to come after the break. Stay tuned, folks. Listen to Hands on Apologetics. I'm Gary Picciuta.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist, and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ from my best-selling book, The Devil and the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered. It's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, West Covina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Master Apologist Paul Thomas about apologetics, Eastern Rite style. And Paul, you know, I love the way you describe the different liturgies and different rites of the church as just different ways of expressing love. You know, that's such a beautiful way to put it.
It's true.
Yeah. And that's why it's beautiful. It's true. And also, you know, and for those listening too, all these groups are in full communion with the Pope. So that they believe the same doctrine, you know, their practices may be different, but, nevertheless, you know, we're, one, you know, one church with one set of doctrines, one set of sacraments. And Paul, you made a really interesting point, and I think this maybe would be the first part we could kind of show how Eastern Rite style apologetics helps out with Western Rite, and that is the idea of the ancient church. You know, living here in Michigan, you know, Paul's also a Michigander. The state I think was founded, if I'm correct, like 1823 or 28, somewhere around there.
Yeah, right around there.
That seems pretty old. You know, and then, you know, in Protestantism, the King James Bible, the King of Jameth, you know, it's from 1611. That seems like really, really old. And if you live in Germany, you might visit the church in Wittenberg, where Luther nailed the 95 Theses, you know, in the early 1500s. And we tend to think of, wow, that is ancient. But from an Eastern Rite perspective, that's just like yesterday, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. The first time, again, I went back to Lebanon with my father, and I got to see where my great-great-great-grandparents lived, because we just built up on our house. Uh-huh. So I'm talking with my uncle, Elias, and he's like, yeah, the last renovation on our house is about 400 years ago. So a renovation on our house is about as old as the entire Reformation. The streets that we walk on usually are over 1,000 years old. Our village church is over 1,200 years old. 500 years is kind of not a long time when you live in place. You know, places in America, 200 years is a historical place. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, this place is 150 years old. Well, it's really not that old in the Middle East. We're more connected physically with history instead of through books and through pictures. We live in the new world. They live in the original world. You know, they live in the world where Jesus walked. His language is still alive. The customs are still alive. We still speak and eat the same food as he did. The parables, he would say, would still work today. There, it's yes. Is it more modern? Yeah. I mean, you go to downtown Beirut or Amman or Damascus, it's very modern. Mm-hmm. But when Jesus was here, it was mainly village life. And it still is about 85-90% village life. You're in your village. You have the people in your village are your family. They're not so much just your neighbors, they're your brothers and sisters, whether it's, you know, 20 generations removed, mm-hmm. you guys are almost all related. Because you've lived in this area for thousands and thousands of years. It's not like you pick up like me and you live, what, about 30 miles apart, 40 miles apart?
Yeah.
And I could just pick up and move to Livonia. Well, you don't pick up and move there because the house you live in is 600-700 years old, given to, and your family's always lived there.
Right.
So you're right. We do think of things differently. Things really haven't changed all that much except the calendar and slight technology, even though in Lebanon, we still lose electricity for 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
In 2019. And all the Lebanese people listening will start laughing because they know what I'm talking about.
Well, we experienced that yesterday. We lost some electricity too. But
well,
yeah,
you lost it when it was supposed to run 24 hours. You didn't lose it because they shut off.
That's true.
Man.
Very good point. But yeah, I mean, for example, you know, non-believers, atheists, well, sometimes they say, well, the Gospels were written so long afterwards that you couldn't really verify, you know, whether the stuff they said is true, that Jesus really did that. And, you know, in American context, that could be true because for us, you know, we are not anchored in our location in tradition. But for a small village, like you said, where people have lived there for generations, if someone came and worked a miracle, you know, that would not easily be forgotten for centuries, right?
No. No. It also comes out of a different tradition of storytelling. Mm-hmm. Writing was a luxury. Most people weren't literate. I mean, I think even Western people take literacy for granted. Like, oh, well, you just take a Bible and you read it for yourself. Well, up until about 120 years ago, that wasn't a thing you could do. First of all, you could barely afford a book. Let's just say 150 years ago. What literacy is, yeah, 150 years old, general thing to have books. Writing was a luxury to even have a papyrus or something to write on. Really, if you look at the time they were written after, it really wasn't that far. I mean, it's within a generation, oh, yeah, within 30 to 50 years. And these are by eyewitnesses writing it, not by a story of a story of a story from an eyewitness. So they're firsthand. And if you really read in scripture like John, whenever when he talks about a miracle of Jesus, he'll always say he did this in Capernaum at the synagogue.
Yeah.
So why don't you go there and ask the people who've seen it?
Yeah.
Because this wasn't written to people 300 years later. It was written to people who are probably still alive.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Second, when did you ever hear anybody write and say that they were wrong? Who really contested what they were saying? I mean, other than the Jews. And the Jews had to because it shook up their power, you know, the power struggle of the Pharisees.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah, well, actually,
maybe modern.
They never denied it. Like, for example, miracles. They never denied Jesus' miracles. But they tried to assign, mm-hmm, like a different power. It wasn't from God. But they couldn't even deny that it happened.
Of course they couldn't. Too many people seen it.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's seen it. But then what did they accuse him of? Well, you cast him out in the name of the devil. And what did Jesus say? How can the devil cast out the devil?
Yeah.
But of course, just like I came back to Catholicism, there's implications of believing certain things. So if you accept one, you got to accept the whole thing. And it's I'm going to tell you, it's from being outside the faith coming in, it's a scary proposition. There's a lot of things in your life you live that you have thought were moral, and you find out they're not moral, and they have become habit, and yeah, they've become a part of your life that's so ingrained of what you do every day. And to hear, you know, I accept this resurrection and I accept this church, but man, I got to accept this moral law. Really? Well, it's either or, you know, what did Jesus say? You're either hot nor cold. You're lukewarm and I'll vomit you from my mouth. I don't want to be vomited from his mouth. I don't want him to cast me away.
Right.
So it's better to be cold than lukewarm. And I mean, again, you know me pretty well. I am not a lukewarm person. I am.
No.
I'm all in or nothing. And that's kind of what he asked us for.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, now, what was the name of the village that you came from?
Oh, my dad's family's from Turza. Yeah, okay. Turza.
So
it's from it's called the Wadi Qadisha, the Holy Valley. We're the first village in it.
Okay, so if a famous rabbi like Jesus, you know, came, worked miracles in your village, it wouldn't be like, well, you know, there's lots of people come in and out. We don't really know whether, you know, he was here or not. That would be something that would stick in the memory of the village, wouldn't it?
Oh, I mean, first of all, if anyone knows any Middle Eastern people, the second it happened, the whole village would know in about 5 seconds. That's just the name. You know,
yeah,
something can happen here. Like something will happen with my family and literally we'll get a call from Lebanon in like 5 minutes. Like,
yeah,
how did you know what happened 5 minutes ago? Because it'll go to Canada, to Lebanon, to us. Oh, the whole village would talk about it. Sure. And again, it's like, it's family. It's not like on your street, if you've seen it, would you go run and tell your neighbors four doors down?
Yeah, probably.
We're not as close here as we are back home. When I say back home, I just mean, you know, my ancestral home. I was born here.
Right.
But you're not close to, you know, we're not close to our neighbors 20 doors down like we are there, because we're all kind of related. So we all just talk. Oh, man, if someone did something like that, everybody would know. They wouldn't let you forget.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And that's just true. Even in America, culture. You know, with smaller towns, you know, it's close-knit.
Oh, yes, it's very like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, so that's one thing, you know, just the how ancient the church is, and also, you know, how tightly knit the culture is. So that, you know, to us, like to a non-believer that's from, you know, born and raised in America, has no contact with ancient societies, you know, that's plausible that, you know, well, maybe these things were made up and, you know, and they couldn't be verified because no one really paid attention to details. And that just wouldn't fly, would it, for someone who's actually in that culture?
No. I'm not going to tell you there's no atheist there. But from what I know of my people, I don't know if my dad's listening, he'll get angry because we're not Arabs, we're Phoenicians. But I am part from my mom, so we're a very religious people. You know, Middle Eastern people are very religious. Whatever faith they are, they take very seriously. Now, granted, there's your secular people, and this is the world.
Sure.
But very religious. That, and when you have contact with the things they're talking about that are still standing. Like in America, you read the Bible and you read about this temple wall, or you read about the cedars of Lebanon, or you read about Babylonian castles. Well, we see them. Like, yeah. We still have Babylonian castles and fire and Sidon that are still standing that are 5,000 years old. Hmm. So history is kind of something that's tangible instead of just something in a book.
Yeah.
So we're more in touch with that history, and it's, we can still feel its repercussions of regime change. You know, when the Hashemites took over, you know, all these countries you see today used to all be great Syria. And then it was all great Jordan. And it's just, it's a different life. And yeah, that's what the church grew out of.
Yeah, very good. Well, we were chatting with Master Apologist Paul Thomas about apologetics, Eastern Rite style. If you have any questions, give us a call at 888-526-2151. We'll be right back right after this.
We got Ernesto from Long Beach.
You know, I just wanted to comment, you know, and I just wanted to thank you guys. And I kind of wanted to encourage people that are listening, maybe that are not donating, you know, because honestly, I gotta be honest, I used to think you guys were a little
too over the top,
you know.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you
that's
know,
right,
if God gave us a lot, you know, and I have the blessing of listening to all this, and I just want to call all the people, you know, I got 5 kids, you know, and I don't make a lot of money, and I'm still donating to you guys.
God bless you, brother. You're amazing.
We have to do this. We have to do the extra. And it's not even the extra. People see it like it's extra. Kneeling for communion, saying your rosary, saying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. It is not extra. It's what the church tells us to do.
Amen. You're a good man, brother.
30 years old, 29 years old, 5 kids, and I thank you guys. But everybody else, man, get on fire. Fight for the truth, man. I know what I'm telling you guys. There's
I
so
love it.
Out there.
Hi, this is Eddie Chavez, host of Jesus 911. I want to take this opportunity to let you, our listeners, know about an event being held here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina. We will be celebrating the Feast of St. Michael the Archangel on September 28th, 2019, beginning at 9 o'clock with Mass in the morning and talks to follow. Ruben Nava and myself will be speaking, so come and hear us talk about St. Michael and Our Lady. Come join us, and we'll see you there.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics, and we are chatting with our Eastern Rite Catholic apologist, Paul Thomas. Just about, you know, how common objections that are launched against the church can have an interesting refutation if you from an Eastern Rite perspective. So that's kind of what we're talking about. And Paul, you know, right before the break, we were talking about memory, and that really gives strength to oral tradition, that if you live in the same area and you're surrounded by, you know, these artifacts as just part of the place that you live, you know, it's a lot easier to remember things because they're kind of like mnemonic devices where, you know, for example, the stones of the temple that was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, they're still there. Mm-hmm. And of course, that would evoke the words of Jesus, not a stone upon another, you know, should be left.
Amen. It also, you can see the sign of the ancient church when you see songs and icons.
Yeah.
How do you evangelize and teach an ancient generation of people? Not through scholasticism that you're dealing with. Most people couldn't read. And that was, you know, a very high educated thing, usually the ruling class and the high religious. You learned by apostolic, you know, oral tradition and pictures. That's why ancient churches are full of icons. This is how you learn. I mean, you can walk in some churches and know the whole life of Christ just on the walls, because that's how we learn. That's why the liturgy is set up the way it is. It walks through the life of Christ. You know, it walks us through the whole life of not even Christ, our faith, on the things that happened and in which order they happened, from his birth to his death, to his resurrection, to Pentecost, to his ascension, and then back over again. And this is how a church that is ancient would have to teach its people, which is why the liturgy is so important. It's the, you know, liturgia, it's the people's prayer. It's not so much an individual thing as it is a community thing. And that's how we all come together and pray and we worship. And that's how we learn our faith, is through the liturgy. And that's how the ancient church learned it too, which is why we're so dogmatic on certain liturgical, not even philosophy, but just on a, like, if people don't know, the Byzantine are the only rite, they use leavened bread for the Eucharist. Hmm. These are Catholics, not Orthodox, but Catholics. Now, there's a reason why they do it. It's not just because they wanted to. You know, the Latin Rite and the Syriac Rite use unleavened bread because it's truer to what Jesus did at the Last Supper. He used unleavened bread. But the Byzantine Rite looks at it as, we are the leaven. We're not Jews anymore. We're different. And we're supposed to be the leaven of the world. So we use leavened bread. So it's not so much to be different, it's just to focus on another truth. That's all. It's a different way to love and a different way to look at it. It's not invalid, it's just different.
Right.
And it's even the way the church is set up with the iconostasis and not seeing the altar until the Eucharistic liturgy, just the one door opens and only the priest can go through. And you only get a glimpse, like a shadow, but you still get to see what's going on. And there's just a lot of different symbolism between the liturgies, and they all reflect different aspects of our universal beliefs, which is, it's just awesome.
Yeah,
it's really
gorgeous.
Cool.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to bring this up. Now, Paul, as you know, we have a incredibly beautiful community of Chaldean Rite Catholics. These are Catholics that, you know, came from Iraq, and just a really great tight-knit community. And several years ago, a friend of mine, a priest, invited me to do apologetics courses for the community. And this is Father Frank Cullabot, who's now Bishop Francis Cullabot.
Bishop Francis, yeah.
That's right. Boy, but anyway, so I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So I'm going through the list, you know, all the basic categories, how to defend your faith, Eucharist, all this. And there was one subject where as soon as I mentioned the objections, the class almost burst out laughing. They thought it was just so ridiculous.
I know where you're going.
What, can you guess what that subject was?
Yeah, the brothers of the Lord.
that's exactly it.
I thought it was funny too, this objection.
Yeah, it was just it didn't even register on their radar screen. They're like, Americans believe that Jesus had brothers and sisters, American Protestants.
I know.
And I'm like, yeah, this is like a really important, you know, a lot of Protestants have stumbling blocks. And they're just like, that's just nuts. But maybe you could explain to your audience why, you know, why would they think it was crazy?
Okay, well, almost all the apostles' first language is Syriac or Chaldean or Sureth or Assyrian.
Yeah, Aramaic.
It's kind of all the same. Aramaic.
Yeah.
So Arabic is really close to it, but Chaldeans speak Aramaic. Mm-hmm. So you probably noticed you're not related to anyone there, but they still probably call you Ammo, which means uncle. That's sort of something you call everybody that is either a friend or close to you that is a senior or like an elder. You call them Ammo. Family, you know? So anyone we know, like from my village, if I were to go there, you won't call each other, hey, cousin, or hey, son of my brother's wife, son's husband. There's no word for cousin. We call each other Ahon. Like in Arabic, it's Hayye, but they would say Ahon in Aramaic.
And that would be what?
Of course, they don't. It means brother.
Brother.
But that is what we call everybody is Ahoni. That's just how we speak. It's not something we go out of our way to say. Like when you hear someone in English, and I say it a lot, what's up, brother? What's up, brother?
Yeah, sure.
But it's literally part of our language. It's not what would you call it? It's not being exclamatory. It's literally how we speak. Is everybody?
Yeah, it's
from,
not slang.
Like, take a village. Yeah, anyone from Tikut Nai, that's one of a huge Chaldean village. Everyone would be Ahon. That's just what you are. That's your brothers and sisters or everybody you're related to in the whole village. So when you see the context of your brothers and sisters are outside, well, yeah. You're Ahoni. They're outside. Well, of course they are. It could be a plethora of people that are my Ahon.
Yeah.
But in Aramaic, we see this and we read it like, well, yeah, of course you said that. What are they going to say? Oh, you're second and third cousins. You know, for me to even say cousin, I have to say the son of my sister or the son of my brother or the son of my brother's son. You don't say that. That's when you have to click. This is another reason why Arabs have so many names. Mm-hmm. And you always hear Ibn, mm-hmm. because we have so many of the same name. Like when he called him Simon Barjona, it'd be like, Bar is Bron, that's your son. You have to differentiate between each other by who your father is. And then sometimes those are the same, so it's got to be who your father's father was. But again, this is a linguistic way we speak, and this is how the Bible was written to us. It's a Semitic book. It was written to mostly Semites. No, it was preached in Greek and in Latin, you know, by Paul. But the books themselves, it's from the East. It's from a Syriac tradition of farmers and fishermen and, heck, even a tax collector.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Syriac, it's written in our language.
Yeah. What I was going to say is that really fits in with what we were talking about earlier, too, where you said the village, like, everybody's related somehow. You know,
yes,
and so it makes sense that you would, use brother and sister in a wide sense because you live in the same village. You wouldn't go through all these permutations about who, you know, your relationship to each other.
You're also dealing with the language of Babylon. This language is over 10,000 years old. It doesn't get into these specific little words. It's not Greek. Hmm. So just like when he says, you know, you are a Kepha, and on this Kepha, I'll build my church. they don't use a word for Little Rock. You'd say, I think how Chaldeans would say it, Zora, Kepha Zora, like a Little Rock. You would have to say Little Rock. We don't have these really big descriptor words. It's a very old language from a long time ago. And some people would call it a dead language. Like Latin's really not a dead language. It just grew into Italian and French and Romanian. And, you know, it changed. But essentially, Latin doesn't change. Well, Aramaic, I mean, it hasn't really changed, but it has a little bit. It's still spoken in households. I mean, my grandparents were only from the 20s, were the first generation of Arabic speakers. We always spoke Syriac in our house. That is what my grandparents spoke. That's what their parents spoke. And it's, but that's unknown to a lot of the world. I mean, a lot of people in the world haven't even met a Chaldean or ever heard anyone speak Aramaic. To them, it's the language of long, long ago in a land far away. And it's not. It's spoken today.
Yeah. Yeah, it's prayed in.
Which
the,
is why they started laughing.
Yeah, exactly. And that was such a surprise because, you know, growing up here, this is we take it as, you know, this is a very serious objection. But really, you know, when you look at it from the Eastern Rite perspective, which is a lot closer to Jesus' culture and language and everything, it really is a no-brainer. It doesn't prove that Mary had other children.
Well, there's another Syriac objection, which you would look for in our tradition of who gets our mother. If I died and I had a brother, my brother would take my mom. Do you know the insult it would be if I had a bunch of brothers and sisters and I died and I gave, and I was the oldest son and I gave my mom to one of my friends?
Yeah.
That would be unheard of. Of course the next brother would take care of mom. It'd be an insult to my whole village if my mom went. And then she moved to Ephesus. She doesn't even live in the community anymore. Jesus wouldn't do this. He was a Jew. This is how we do things. And, I mean, he gave Mary to the youngest apostle. And then they left. So if he did have brothers, why would he have done that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, even from, again, from our culture, it would be something so abnormal to do that.
Yeah. Or I've heard that when Jesus' brothers tell him what to do, give him advice, that younger siblings never give older siblings advice in that culture.
No. And the older son traditionally gets everything. And he disperses the father's stuff to the children.
Right.
Technically, we give inheritance to our children while they're alive, not when we're dead. Which is why you usually see our parents living with usually the oldest child. We bring our parents in, and then the parents want to watch us spend their money. That's their joy, which is, again, even the Syriac way of interpreting the prodigal son. His sin wasn't so much asking for his inheritance. It was going and spending it without the father being able to see. So
very good. Well, hey, I hear the music. You know, this is the fastest hour on Catholic
hour
Talk.
Of radio.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
God bless you, Gary.
All right. Thank you. And, yeah, next week we got Biggie. We have lots of great guests. We have Mike Aquilina, Roy Showman, Kenneth Hensley, and Dr. Robert Delfino coming on. Thank you so much for listening to the program. Coming up next, High Intensity Catholic Talk with Gary and Jesse Show. It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center, turn off the dojo lights. Everybody have a great week. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.